Hello, everyone. I'm Brianna Kinsman, and this is the Culture Care Podcast, Light Through the Cracks. Welcome to part two of our conversation with poet, novelist, and forgiveness scholar, Shan Ray. In this conversation, at our extended kintsugi table, Mako, Shan, and I explore forgiveness-seeking as a way toward cultural and interpersonal mending. Before we jump into part two, I invite you to enter this space by taking a deep breath in and slowly letting it out. Here's Shan Ray and my co-host, Mako Fujimura.
Hey, Shan, we have talked about my exhibit, one of my major, I think one of my most important exhibits to in my career was at the Gonzaga University Zhang Museum.
Oh, we loved it. It was so amazing. And just for the rest of you out there, let me just tell you, we didn't know, Mako and I didn't know, but there is a huge following for Mako's work in the Northwest. I mean, we didn't quite know that. We put this on. And it was just so beautifully done by the Junt Museum. I mean, the way it was curated, incredible, you know. And then we had these events, and they were, every time, they were standing room only. Like, people couldn't get in. Every time. And so people came, some people came from Asia to just be at this, not knowing that they, hoping they might get to meet Mako, but not knowing, just to witness it, you know. So let alone around the U.S., but. Yeah. So keep going, Mako.
I was going to say, you hosted me as a business school side, leadership.
Yes. You were visiting in the School of Leadership Studies. Yeah.
So counterintuitive to many, right? Why, it wasn't just a museum hosting me, but it was a school of leadership. Yeah. Talk a little bit about that, the tribes that you inhabit at Gonzaga University, which range from business leaders, CEOs of companies, you consult with companies as well, and, you know, you teach about forgiveness in the context of business sector.
Yes. Well. You know, I think, like we might imagine, when I say the economy means nothing, that's a little bit of a misnomer, right? We all do have to live and survive. And then there are just gifted people with economy as well, and deeply loving, deeply influencing, and desiring to, I would say, be of service to artists and to those interested in love, forgiveness, reconciliation. And then let alone just inside the businesses that I've had the grace and honor to work with. There's just so many businesses that are crying out, and this wasn't happening 30, 40 years ago, but now it's happening all the time. Can you come in and teach us about forgiveness? Can you teach us how to ask forgiveness? Can you teach us how to make amends with each other? I mean, I never got asked those things 30 years ago in business, you know. And it happens all the time. I just got a text today. We have to work on forgiveness. This is the two upper leaders of a large multi-million dollar operation. We have to work on forgiveness. Can you meet Wednesday? You know, and because we've had this relationship, right? They both know that we're going to come into that meeting, and we're going to, you know, be prepared with humility. It's such a strange thing to be working this way in business, right? So everybody knows we're coming to that meeting. Ideally, you know, praying for humility and asking for humility if we're not somebody that's directly religiously oriented or spiritual oriented, asking for humility. And we're coming to the meeting with the goal of asking forgiveness and making things right and building plans that would reconcile. And that's just happening all over. And I think we sometimes forget that it, you know, in the business world, it's equally as desired or needed or vibrant, you know. And so, yeah, that has been amazing. And I attribute that to the Jesuits. Jesuits would say too, with all their flaws, they have had very elegant responses to the deep rifts of the world. And so one of the ways that I think they respond is through wholeness, you know, back to the kintsugi idea, making things whole. And so for you know, working at a Jesuit university, it's natural that leadership, business, and forgiveness would be hand in hand, whereas it's not natural a lot of other places.
Yeah, but you noted just now, and you know, my daughter Lydia is an organizational psychologist, and she's been telling me for years that understanding of empathy is key for organizational health. And yet, you know, as you know, maybe 10 years ago, this would not even be a conversation. No. What do you think happened? What is the shift in happening in business cultures?
I think there's a vacuum. There's a vacuum created by violence. And into that vacuum will come intimacy. And if we allow it, if we humbly recall it or listen to it. And so vacuum in American life is militarism, materialism. You know, so if we take the business side, the materialism side, you know, how much money can you make? How much dominance can you do in business? And then where are you? You know, I mean, the vacuum of alienation, loneliness, really, we see it. What's the most dominant part of American society economically? Well, it would be white males from, my guess would be from 35 to 70. Well, guess what has the highest suicide rates? That exact group. That's painful. That's a vacuum into which intimacy must come. So I think the next generation at this time has responded with, I experienced that. I saw that in my uncle or my father or my brother, or in others that I know. And we need deep healing. You know? So I think that's one of the new generation is just wants something different than that emptiness that is just the pursuit of money for the pursuit of money, you know. And I think universities have responded to, you know, that it was just 35 years ago that there were zero programs with the term leadership inside universities. There isn't a university in America that doesn't have a leadership program now. And that came from these big scandals, right? The dot-com scandal and the Arthur Andersen scandal and the government auto industry, you know, government scandals and auto industry scandals, all the big, you know, schools start going, I guess teaching business ethics hasn't worked, you know, so doesn't mean leadership's going to work. It just was a good catch term. So, but it gave us a chance to teach, oh, well, what would making things right look like? What making things whole? If we taught that inside the leadership world or the business world or the psychology world, the theology world, we have a little better chance to maybe listen to the what's required, which would be ask for forgiveness and making things whole. So there is a bit of a linearity to it that ends up, right, producing the machine again, too. But it's the machine's not all wrong. It's can be helpful, you know, if we have a humility to it. But, you know, university, for example, it sounds good that they started leadership programs, but they knew that, you know, parents would pay for somebody to get a leadership minor, you know, or leadership major. So it's also economically driven as well as, you know, morally or spiritually driven.
And I think there's something to that too, that you're bringing the body back into the conversation. Whereas, you know, leadership has, I guess in the way that I was raised to think about leadership, it was very cognitive driven and or knowledge based, or in terms of having any kind of bodily shape, it was kind of, you know, what does the look of a leader and yes. This very Americanized, like
power stance, power suit,
yep, the handshake, all of that. But when you talk about humility, you know, coming, if we're going to have a conversation about forgiveness, we, you know, the leaders in the room know we're going to come to a conversation about humility and that this is the posture we're going to take.
Yeah.
And I love how through all the stories you've shared just in this conversation, they've all been related back to an encounter or ritual or a mass or an act even generations later of planting something that's done physically and not just something that you can think your way through, but something that truly requires an encounter. And
requires the body, doesn't it? Right.
Yes.
I love what you said. Yeah.
An incarnational expression. Yeah.
It's almost like the body laid down. The body laid down.
Yes.
Yes. Maybe, for example, my wife and I. She's a gorgeous soul, and she would call me in the marriage at times to let's lay on the floor in the form of a cross, or on top of me, and listen to music and listen to a loving message from God. And I think it's somewhat that form. Let's be united and listen to music and to a loving message from God. And so I love it that you brought it. And your words were, because there's a little bit of a skip in the audio for a second. And I thought you said it's about burning back the body. And you said bringing back the body. And I was like, oh, yes. The ancient tradition of eating our humiliation. But it was just a slip, but it was, brought about that exact thing, that there is truly the burning back. We're basically trying to burn back the ego body to, in order to listen, and that lifts us or helps us transcend the shame cycle.
And I wonder, I think about this in the work I do with, I run a playback theater troupe, and playback theater takes stories from the audience based on a prompt and then uses improv and movement and music to play it back on the spot.
Yes. Yeah.
Audience member. And so with theater and with writing and your work in as a poet and the author of many books, I think that there is something to wherever we go from here to reach the atonement and the mending to make new that we desire. There is something to the point that the body will be undoubtedly involved. And I wonder how much of this will actually be played out through story, through ritual, as you spoke of having that experience in a forgiveness ceremony. And I think that sometimes theatrical or theater is used as, or performance is used in kind of a, we don't, something that's negative or, oh, it was so performative and unreal, disingenuine. Sure. I think that performance truly, it just means that we're carrying it out into its fullness. And so I wonder, what do you think? Is there a sense that there is a need for organized and storied representations to get us in that space?
Think of the impact of Hamilton.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, currently right now, the impact of The Good Lord Bird, the series that's out right now, James McBride's book, that's as a series right now. The authentic performative brings about wholeness or brings us into the fullness. And I think in America, especially since it's been a linearized, rationalized, that's been given privilege, militarized, materialized. Those are things that have been given, privileged as the ultimate, the storied, the mystery, the circular, the art, the feminine, the spectrum is up from there is exactly where healing and transcendence, forgiveness and mercy is emerging. It's not emerging much from the over-linearized, over-rational. That's usually, from a psychological perspective, also in its shadow, the ultra rational is what we would call very dry. It doesn't have sweat and juice and blood, and it has excellence and there's certain gifts to it, but that isn't where we're going to get the blooming that we need that comes from the soil and the earth and the grit and the blood and the decomposing that allows us to come into the life of composing.
Right, yeah. And in in American Copper, there's a relationship with the land that you write about too. And I hear that too in your own story, and that place is very important to you. And in our previous episode, we were able to have a conversation with Susie Abero, who works directly with the sounds of the land and listening
yes,
to the
water,
land.
The sound of water. I mean, even just those words. Those words heal us. The sound of water.
Yes, yes. Wow. So, how? I wonder, from your perspective, as a psychologist, as a teacher, a father, and a son, and one who is writing their way toward mending to make new, how is our relationship with place and with land involved with this? Where does healing take place? So how do we forgive something outside of how do we seek forgiveness from the land?
Especially itself? With our dominance, which has resulted in the rape of the land, and it's not for nothing that the land is called Mother Earth, and that we, in our high linearity and rationalizations, can excuse deep harm against our mother. Mm. And that's a painful reality that we, I think most scientists in that area would predict we are at such a level that we're going to annihilate ourselves and our mother, you know, which is back to this, you know, inappropriate drive to, which, you know, if I have been shamed consistently, if I don't receive a deep healing, I will shame others consistently. And I think that's where we see the toxic remnant of American genocidal dominant power is it comes up through self-shame, and then it enacts shame on others. Because before that, it was shamed. You know? And so that cycle has to be legitimately broken. I would say the same with the land and you know, frame the land as feminine, I think is very helpful. You know, the feminine has the capacity to heal us and make us whole. And the masculine does as well. However, this is a unique time when it's obvious that a certain type of patriarchal, what bell hooks called white supremacist patriarchal dominance, has ruled the Western world. And so we're in need of the healing from our mother. So I literally like to just be in the rivers and the lakes of Montana, you know, and bodily again, just experience, you know. So the COVID time has been painful and yet also freeing in some ways. And so as a psychologist, my office just became my car.
And my car happens to be an old silver GT Mustang, which is fun. And so since that's my office, in the summer, I just parked my office next to the Spokane River. And in between sessions with people, I would just go lay in the river, swim, and dive off rocks, and then come back to my car. So you know, and it's been one of the most fulfilling times as a psychologist, and I think it's because of being healed along the way by our mother, if that makes sense, you know. And so I agree with you. I think it's, how do we ask forgiveness of our mother? You know, I mean, it would be at large scale, it would be, you know, a legitimate strategies coming up from, again, from non-dominant culture that would allow for protection and safety and healing of our mother while we receive her grace.
I think I so resonate with that. And I was just in a workshop this past weekend, and I don't remember who exactly said this quote, but it was the spiritual ecology workshop, and they said, we have to stop this relationship of we're going to save, we're going to heal Mother Earth. Yes. But see, as Mother Earth is going to heal us.
Yeah, we're going to listen.
Ourselves open to that.
Yeah. I love that. My mentor as a young psychologist was Sister Carmel Gregg. She's a Franciscan sister, beautiful person. And she would come to me and sometimes say, basically she'd be saying, you have to listen more, you know, speak less. But then she would say, I would say, man, I'm waking up with fear, you know, over the people that I'm seeing and their lives, you know, because you might have four or five suicidal people in your caseload and you love them and you want for their deep life, you know. And her simple response was, well, first, you're not the Messiah. Repeat that to me, please. Just her delightful, you know, way first, you're not the Messiah. And then second, you know, and she would teach this centering, Franciscan centering prayer, which is contemplative, breathing oriented prayer, very, very making things whole type of prayers, you know. And I still practice them every day, you know, from her movement there. But yeah, I agree with you, Brianna. This is so, so true, that listening and being healed by the earth, our mother.
Yeah. I imagine that many of our listeners are coming to this threshold with various views, various feelings in their body, even now, just having listened to this conversation, and maybe with many questions too about how to move toward forgiveness. And so I wonder if, to close, if you would mind just sharing with us, how can we begin to befriend our shadows? How do we take that first step into the land of forgiveness?
I love that, taking our first steps into the land of forgiveness. I think it's very hard. It depends on so much depends on how much each of us individually and collectively have been harmed. So it's so, I think, fortunate that my blood is both German and Czech, you know, both the dominator and the dominated, both the healer and the healed. And I wouldn't have known that, but coming up into it through family and hearing their stories, and then directly being associated with people that had gone through great trauma, and they themselves were, they had made that turn from forgiveness is necessary, forgiveness is good, into forgiveness asking is also necessary, or maybe even more necessary, and making atonement is necessary and good. And so that, not a non-binary separation between granting forgiveness and asking forgiveness, but a mutualized life and collective that asks forgiveness and makes things right, and that forgives openly and easily. And so I had individual people, so I would say it would be to be with and come around those people. And the first encounter, it was probably good to tell as a story. So I came into my wife's, future wife's family, and we're at the dinner table, and her dad says a sharp word to her mom. And in my family, that was literally a nothing. I actually thought he said, he was really kind how he said it. Because in my family, what he said and how he said it was a -8. On the 100-point scale of verbal violence. So I literally, in my head, as a 17-year-old, said, wow, I'm handled really well. Okay. Later, I'm sitting on the couch, and I see him and his wife. This is Fred and Susie. Fred's over at the, you know, talking to Susie in the kitchen. And he comes and sits down next to me, and he says, I'd like to ask your forgiveness for my rudeness to my wife at the dinner table. And this is the first time I'd ever heard anybody ask forgiveness. And by then, I'd already been in the Christian churches quite a bit. But, you know, conveniently, inside Christianity or inside Islam or inside Buddhism, we can also harbor our shadows without facing them, you know, or inside atheism or inside any belief stand. And so, interestingly, inside Christianity, you know, might be one of the lesser places that you actually hear people ask forgiveness, which sounds hilarious and awful. And but then I have to turn it on myself. Well, how much am I asking forgiveness? You know, it's not, it can't be outside, you know, like, I can't believe those churches aren't asking forgiveness. I mean, if no one can say that unless they're actually asking forgiveness and going through that difficult deep change themselves, right? So in any case, I'm on the couch, and Fred says that, you know, I'd like to ask you forgiveness. And I literally said, you know, I was kind of, I don't know what I would call it, a little embarrassed, a little didn't know what to say. You know, it was, you're entered into a moment that, in my case, I was not at all prepared for. And, you know, looking back, he knew that, and, you know, but this is just part of his life and the way that he moves in the world, and his wife as well, and my wife, thankfully. And in any case, he says, well, I say, oh, you don't have to ask me. You don't have to ask my forgiveness. And then, you know, because part of my generational temperament at that point was what we would call placating, you know, like always trying to make things good or peacemaking, but of course that lacks the sort of authentic power that's needed for true peacemaking. Yeah. But in any case, I didn't know any of that. I'm just sitting on a couch. And so he says that, and I, oh, you don't have to ask me. And then he says, he said something like, I don't ask just for you, though that's important. One of the things that we try to do as a family is when we wrong each other, we ask forgiveness, not only of the person that we harmed, but of everybody else who was present in order to restore the dignity of the one that was harmed. So you can basically see all this powerful reparation, reconciliation movement just in language right there. And of course, if we put that out, you know, on a world scale, it would back to listening to those that are not the dominant culture to lead us, you know, listening to that grace to lead us into what real atonement looks like, you know.
Jan, I have been in your house. Yes. You've hosted me so many times graciously, even when I was going through my darkness, and counseled me. And I met Fred and Susie, and yes. And they exactly as you described. Blessed to that. And Jan, I was wondering that Franciscan prayer. Is it possible to recite that for us?
Well, it was a style, a bodily style, you know. And I often do put specific prayers on top of it. But it was basically to breathe in and to raise your hand, you know, raise your hands up towards your face as you breathe in through breathe in deeply through your nose. And then let your hands run down your body with some touch, but also and down and out and away from your body on the out breath. On a deep out breath. And then she just, Sister Carmel, just taught me specific prayers inside there. Like, as you breathe in perfect love. As you breathe out fear. As you breathe in color. As you breathe out gray. Those are the first two she taught me, and I pretty much still harbor those. But I also then put on top of it poems or, you know, like different things that I'll be breathing in and, you know, breathe in the shirt of flame that T.S. Eliot spoke of. Breathe out the desire to resist the shirt of flame. You know, so it just expands as life goes on as an artist, as you know, these things just become part of our lives.
That's beautiful. Would you mind if we just all did that together, even as you just did it now?
Yeah, I'll lead us. So, okay. So wherever you are and, you know, find a comfortable place, I'm just sitting in a chair. And you would just breathe in through your nose with me and lift your hands up to your face. And then you would move your hands down with the out breath, down through your body and out away from you. And breathe out. Let's just practice that a few times. Breathe in deeply through your nose and lift your hands up towards your face. And you breathe out and take the hands down through the body. You touch, you know, and move the hands out. The deep out breath. So let's just practice that with that original prayer that Sister Carmel taught me. As you breathe in perfect love. As you breathe out fear. And as you breathe in color. And as you breathe out gray. With blessing and peace. Thank you, Mako. Thank you, Brianna.
Thank you so much, Jan. This has been such an enriching conversation on forgiveness as encounter, forgiveness embodied, forgiveness that leads us toward one another and back to self and back to God. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Culture Care Podcast, Light Through the Cracks. We're thankful for all of you, the listeners in this community. One way you can continue to support the Culture Care Podcast is by liking and subscribing wherever you listen. This helps us to get noticed and, therefore, to extend this kintsugi table to others. You can also support Culture Care Creative on Patreon. If you are a supporter, keep an eye out for an upcoming virtual Q&A event with Mako about his new book, Art and Faith. If you are new to Patreon, there you'll find a series of offerings to thank you for your generosity. The music in this episode is by Koheleth and Susie Ibera. Today's episode was produced by Julia Hendrickson, Joseph Gallagher, Jeremy Hunt, Mako Fujimura, and I'm Brianna Kinsman. Until next time, may our bodies, our whole lived-in selves, become familiar passengers of forgiveness. May our breath, like bread, become our daily grace. Bye, friends.